was created for now. I'm gonna let you know what I'm feeling now. I must be quite emphatical. I'm feeling plain ecstatical. I might just float right up to the sea.
Hi, everybody out there. It's wonderful to be with you again as we see some of the events that have transpired in the last week in the world and some of the things going on that somehow aren't explainable. And I can't help but think, who are these people? And perhaps every now and then I do think, who were they before? So tonight I have on Stephen Sakellarius, who is an expert in reincarnation, has studied reincarnation in conjunction with Eastern philosophy and comparative religion since his late teens, around 1973. And he began studying the Western research in earnest, really profoundly, let's see what they're talking about 3 years ago for the documentary and his website entitled In Another Life. He has masters in counseling and human systems from FSU, during which time he studied the hospice movement and taught a free class on death and dying. I have a lot of questions to ask him on this. He served on the board of an organization which started the first hospice in Tallahassee, Florida. And his documentary, In Another Life, was broadcast on PBS in Denver earlier this year. It's available, if you want to purchase it, on our site in Shirley's Theater. I think you might find it quite interesting because it presents a very thorough examination of reincarnation, which is what we're going to talk about now. So welcome to the show, Stephen. It's wonderful to have you.
Thanks, Shirley. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this, as we all know, and a lot of people make jokes about me and stuff like that. But
I actually have one on my website.
What is it? Let's hear it.
Oh, it's the cartoon. It's one of the Far Side cartoons. It's got a couple little Gila monsters out in the desert, and one says, there it is again, that feeling that I was Shirley MacLaine in a previous life.
I have that. I love that cartoon.
Yeah,
only I think mine were dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Tell me how you got interested in this topic. This is, how did it happen? Did you have this feeling since you were little, or?
Well, I did. All the time I was growing up, I think that I had past life memories, but I had no way to explain what they were. I had no category to put them in and nobody to talk to them about, and that's not that unusual. Apparently that's fairly normal for especially little kids up to about age 5. I know I felt a tremendous sense of nostalgia when I was losing them. You know, it's like I was trying not to lose it, and then I lost track of what it was I was trying not to lose, but I always felt like I was losing something, and if I could just remember what it was.
You mean losing a memory,
or losing
an imaginary friend that you knew before? What do you mean?
I don't think it was an imaginary friend. I think it was places that I lived, you know, and I've kind of identified where some of them probably were now.
Mm-hmm. But
at the time, I had no conceptual place to hang it. You know, I had no idea what it was.
You know, I had my first past life recognition when I was about 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Jamestown, and I knew I had been there. And then later on in adulthood, I went back and was positive.
Yeah.
And went through some of the experiences of the first landing of the pilgrims.
Mm.
So did you trace them through? Did you do past life therapy, or what made you think, hey, this is real?
Well, let's see. I mean, I did a couple sessions of past life therapy, one of them at a workshop conducted by Roger Wilger.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had to, it was a condition of taping him and doing an interview with him that I had to participate in the workshop because mm-hmm. he wanted to be sure I understood what he was about.
Right.
Some previous documentarian had just kind of barged in, shot the most dramatic footage and left, and you know, he wanted to know that I really understood it. So I took the opportunity when he wanted volunteers. I immediately threw my hand up, you know, and got to be a volunteer under him.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a couple experience, two or three lifetimes that I experienced while he was demonstrating there for the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them had come up in a past life reading that I had had also, which was a Celtic priest apparently.
Mm-hmm.
That's the strongest one for me that I'm pretty sure about.
And how does that impact your life today?
Well, that person is with me, and it took me, I'm 49 now. It took me, you know, up until about age 40 to really integrate that and see what were the strengths about that life and what were the weaknesses and what did I need to learn from, you know, how did I need to move on from what that person was.
Mm-hmm.
And also traumas, because apparently that person was betrayed by the people around him and was either throttled or choked to death or, you know, throat was slit or something. So I carried that feeling of betrayal with me, I think, for a long, long time. So I had to.
And do you think that feeling of betrayal came from only that lifetime, or do you think that others before kept on moving over to the next one?
I think there's a tendency to get stuck, you know, like a repeating record. You know, when there's some trauma like that, you go back to it, you experience it from this side and that side, and, you know, until you finally, you know, get free of it. So I'm sure that there's been more than that. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But what Roger Wilger found, if you read his book, Other Lives, Other Selves,
mm-hmm.
if you go back far enough, you find that you were the perpetrator eventually.
Of the betrayal.
Yeah, right.
So that's the law of cause and effect.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So apparently the way it actually works out is you end up doing something, and my guess is you do it because you get kind of lulled into it because it's socially appropriate in that culture. You know, in warfare or for some reason or other, you know, you're in a position of authority and society says it's okay, you can do this. And then if you have the moral fiber, the inner directedness to say, no, I'm going to buck society, that's not right, then you don't accrue the karma.
Mm-hmm.
If you get lulled into, society says this is okay, I think I'm going to go ahead and do this,
mm-hmm.
and you accrue the karma, and then once you do that, then the repercussion doesn't just happen once. It echoes and echoes and echoes and echoes,
yeah.
Echoes down lifetimes until you face it.
You know, so many people are beginning to ask the question now, why did they choose the parents that they chose?
Mm-hmm.
Let's get into that a little bit, particularly people who have had the experience of abuse in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a touchy subject, and I'm real careful. You know, sometimes I answer questions for people that write me, and I'm real careful with that because they're usually not quite ready to get out of that victim role. But,
yeah, but maybe you should help them in a shocking way to do that.
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. I've certainly done my share of trying to shock people. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my personality. But I think the deal is that our parents are there to stimulate and re-stimulate our own deep mental impressions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're there to reawaken the particular impressions that are going to be focused on in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't do all of them. We got so many lives, as near as I understand. There's no way we can do all the homework. So we're allotted certain courses, just like in college.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get English 101 and whatever, and those are the particular issues that have to get raised. So your parents in your early life situation is there to reawaken that whole set of issues for you. But you created those issues yourself sometime a long time ago. They couldn't possibly be reawakened in childhood if you hadn't created them.
So you're saying then this theory of creating all the reality we experience happened in our experience, but you're not saying it's basically a karmic reaction. In other words, if you're experiencing an abusive lifetime now, were you the perpetrator of abuse before?
I would say, well, I don't know that it's quite that lockstep, but it works on subjective experience and motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to reawaken the mental impressions connected with it, it has to be something subjectively similar. So it might not be the exact same situation, it might not be the exact same people, but what's going to get reawakened is the subjective experience. So this is something that happened in one of my regressions, and I can tell you about it or I can just talk about the theory, either one.
No, tell us about it, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story. I had had difficulties in relationships, and I wanted to find out, where is this coming from? You know, why do I have this terrible feeling of being rejected, of falling so deeply for somebody and getting rejected? You know, and I've moved past it now. I'll tell you, I'm in a good relationship as of 3 years, but for a long time I kept hitting the same subjective experience over and over and over, very painful. So I went to a therapist here, and as I was sitting outside waiting for the previous person to be finished, you know, it was a suburban house, and the office was kind of in the back, you know, behind, and I was in the backyard in a little garden, and it was dusk, and I was sitting there, and I was hearing a bagpipe player, you know, and I was thinking, well, that's interesting. Somebody's practicing the bagpipes out here in a suburban neighborhood, and they played 1, 2, 3 songs, and I think the appointment was 7:30, and right at 7:30, they played Amazing Grace, and then that was it. They stopped, and that was the time for the appointment. The person comes out, I go in, I introduce myself, and I say, that's neat that you have somebody who practices, plays bagpipes in the neighborhood. She says, we do. So she had no idea that anybody played bagpipes in the neighborhood. I have no idea, you know. It's like a John Edwards kind of thing.
Right.
You know, so I don't know. I assume there really was somebody, but it was, you know, a little synchronicity thing going on there. So I tried to be hypnotized before. It didn't work. So I didn't know for sure I was going to go under. But as I started, I felt the spirit surrounding me. And I did go into hypnotic state where I'm conscious of what's going on, but at the same time I'm experiencing other realities at the same time. It's a dual kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And what I experienced, in my case, I don't go into full immersion. Some people do. I just get glimpses, you know, flashes.
Uh-huh.
And the flash I got was a complete, total situation. I was somewhere, and I was a person, and I had a history, and I was in a situation. I knew the whole thing. But it was like a fraction of a second of a whole situation, right?
Was it Scottish?
Not in this case. There's another thing I can tell you about that's Scottish. But in this case, I hate to say this because it'll be difficult for people to believe, but it was an advanced civilization of some kind. And the first thing I saw was a room, like a box, and it was made out of a dark... I can't really describe the material. I've seen tabletops that look like it. It's kind of mottled. It's kind of soapy. It's and it's dark, and it's like either, you know, black or gray or maybe dark purple or something. Anyway, it was a box made out of this material, and I knew that it was a punishment, you know, room. You go into the room, and you experience pain, okay? And I knew that I, you know, was responsible for putting people in that. And then I got this.
But you were responsible.
Right. I was responsible for that. Then I got this entire flash that I was in a position of authority. I had lost a mate, a partner, and I was grieving, but my response to grieving was to make other people, other couples, go through that loss also. See? So, and I was enjoying it sadistically, and I was pretending that I was sorry for them. You understand? I mean, so I experienced being sadistic. Well, I'm not a sadistic person, but for a split second, I experienced it, and I knew at that instant that that was the emotional inverse of the pain I'd been going through in my relationships.
Right.
Exact emotional inverse, subjectively.
Mm-hmm.
See? So it was like, and that's where the Amazing Grace came in. This whole thing was like set up for me by my guides or my master, I don't know. But it was clearly set up, and that was all I was given. But that was the answer to my question.
Mm-hmm. And what did the psychiatrist think when that happened?
I'm sorry?
You were in therapy, right?
Well, it was a one-shot deal. I basically went to get that experience. That was what I was supposed to get.
And then your experiences of not being able to sustain a relationship shifted?
Yeah. Yeah, it did. I met a really neat girl, and, you know, we're in a good relationship. That was about three and a half years. And,
so in other words, as soon as you understood that you had perpetrated pain on others, the inverse reality of it was that you were doing it to yourself.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And then I think there was an element of forgiveness. I think I really think that's where...
You had to forgive yourself.
Yeah, and there was also an element of grace in it. I mean, I think it wasn't an accident that the bagpiper played Amazing Grace right before I walked into that session.
But that's interesting that there was a bagpiper there that nobody else heard.
Yeah, she lived there. She never heard him, so, you know, I mean, who knows, you know, who knows. It's interesting.
Well, tell me, what was the Scottish one you were going to try to remember?
Okay, well, yeah, that's also bagpipes. Interestingly enough, I'm ashamed to admit this, but I downloaded a song off the internet, and it was a little bagpipe tune played with a single bagpipe, probably one of those under-the-arm kind of deals, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it was a tune that was very stately and very measured, and I had a flash, very quick flash, and I was standing at attention, and there were people standing with me at attention to my side, to both sides.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like front to back. It was side to side, and there was something in front of us. I don't know what, maybe a gap or a hole or open space or something. And I was listening to the music, and I was enthralled with the music. I was absolutely blissed out with the music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is in the past, in the flash.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a sense of finality, like something was wrong, something was ended, something was dawning on me, something momentous was dawning on me, and I was very confused. So I felt like a little child, like a child is taken to a concert and they don't really know what's going on. That's
mm-hmm.
a feeling, except that that's not quite right either. So when I think about it, I think I was dead. You know, I really think that I was in my astral body, and I was standing there, which happens to people, apparently, and they don't know they're dead. So I'm standing there at attention at my own funeral, you know, blissing out on the music and wondering, you know, who it is, you know. So anyway, I've been corresponding with a fellow in Britain, I believe it was, who's interested in these things. And I sent him a clip of the music. And he wrote me back, and he says, well, that tune goes, there was a Scottish soldier who went a-wandering. You know, so I haven't studied the history any further, but it doesn't sound unlikely that could have been played for a Scottish soldier who was, you know, killed in battle, one would assume.
Now, what I'm wondering, Steve, is because it's important, at least to me right now, that you heard that Scottish bagpipe before you had the revelation of being basically a sadist.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if on some level that Scottish lifetime of being the soldier hadn't preceded your standing at your own death.
Well, it's hard to say. The one I experienced in the hypnotic regression was an advanced civilization, so one would assume if there were such things, which I think there were, 60,000 years ago, something like that, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know my particulars. Maybe you know better than I do. Lemuria and Atlantis and all of that. I have no idea. I had no sense of where it was or when it
was.
But that's when those things happened, so that would be old.
You know, when you felt that box of torture or whatever,
mm-hmm.
In an advanced civilization, what was the point of it?
I have no idea. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw it from a distance. I saw it from the outside. I immediately knew what it was. I can still feel it. As we're talking now, it comes back. The feeling comes back to me. I can feel it. I knew what it was, you know, but I have no idea. I mean, I can't. See, that's the thing. It's glimpses, and they're
yeah.
very strong, but you know, I could sit here, and then, you know, your speculation would be as good as mine.
Yeah. You know, because it could have been you were in charge of putting people in isolation so that they could know themselves better.
Yeah.
And that's painful,
that was
all right.
Yeah, what it was. Yeah, but and again, I have some pretty definite ideas about these things in terms of how valid they are. You know, I'm not going to say this is definitely a past life or that I can prove it or that I'm sure of it. I can say that it was some core memory and that what I experienced, you know, had some validity, but whether it was technically exactly the way I remembered it, you know, I don't know.
Well, the other thing is there such a thing as past life? Or are we experiencing all things concurrently? And so you tap into some other experience that your soul is experiencing even now. In other words, we're all experiencing all time at once. Now, we know that not only Einstein, but many other scientists have said we invented time, we human beings did. So the real truth of it is that all time is happening at once, and therefore the concept of past lives is faulty. It's the only way we can define it in terms of how we process it.
I think from the level of the soul, that's true. If we could experience things from the level of the soul, my understanding is that at that level, everything's now.
Mm-hmm.
But from the level of the ego, which continues after we die, you know, when we die, we're still the same ego, you know, from that level in terms of, you know, I'm in my physical body, I'm out of it, I'm in another one, I'm out of it. At that level, I think time, you know, at the ego level, I think time is there. So it depends on, you know, what level of reality you're talking about. That's my personal feeling. I don't believe that at the ego level where I am now in my experience, as long as I think I'm an individual person named Steve Sakellarius, time is linear, you know?
Well, sure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know that your soul is who you really are,
right,
and that Steve Sakellarius is who you are presenting yourself in terms of the lessons you need to learn now.
Right. So
but
I think
that
it's,
your
I guess
soul is plugged into all time,
mm-hmm.
even now.
I know,
I'm interested in the bagpipes, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I certainly resonate with them now. You know, when I hear it, I still have the same feeling. There's another little one, and that is that I know I've played the organ before well, really well.
Because
I sit down at an organ, at a keyboard. First, if I hear the music, I'm transported. But secondly, when I sit down at a keyboard, I should be able to play this thing. Very, very frustrating feeling, you know. And I can a little bit, but I should be able to just rip it off. Just sit down and play Bach, just bang, you know, and rip it off and enjoy it. And I can't, you know. It's not working anymore, you know.
Well, unless you got rid of the blocks of linearity.
Yeah, if I did, if I was at that level, you know. If I was at that level, I probably wouldn't care.
Yeah, because I think these past life memories influence us every day in meeting a new person, in not liking someone immediately, in being moved by something no one else is. You know, it's happening all day long.
I agree with you, all the time, yeah.
Yeah, and if we... Now, do you think in opening up to experience happening to us all at once, it can drive you crazy?
I think it could if you weren't prepared for it. I think that it's a matter of preparation, and I think it's a natural unfolding. I personally don't think it ought to be forced unless maybe for therapeutic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I think it unfolds naturally, and gradually you start having dreams, you start having feelings, it starts becoming... What I hear from other people and what I've experienced is that as you unfold personally and spiritually, it starts getting more and more real to you. It becomes a part of your everyday life where you start to realize it. Yeah.
So you go to a new job,
you meet somebody, and you know you've known them before, and you know basically what it was like. you know whether you were friends or enemies, or you know, and it just becomes natural.
And if you don't like them, and it's because you know you were enemies, then your lesson would be to try to resolve that and come to terms with it.
Exactly.
Then if the other person doesn't meet you halfway, that's a problem. But
well, you can do your work on your end, and let it go on your end.
Yeah. That you make the attempt yourself.
Yeah, absolutely, and I've done that a number of times.
Yeah, you talk about how the tolerance is one of the finest fruits of reincarnation. And
yeah,
that
in one
if
of
we
articles.
Take our strengths and our weaknesses from the past into each of our lives, I don't know, maybe one of the whole reasons for being alive is to become allowing and tolerant. Do you think so?
To what, I'm sorry?
One of the reasons for being alive is to become tolerant and allowing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so, too. And one of the things that, you know, you sent me that question, and one of the things that occurred to me when I read it was one of the big reasons that reincarnation functions the way it does is for us to recognize our weaknesses as weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
And because most of the time we go around covering over our weaknesses as being strengths. And I can think of a million examples, but I thought, Steve, you know, stick to yourself, you know. So the example that I thought of is going back to this Celtic priest. I think that person was very sensitive, was like a nature mystic, and very otherworldly and not very practical, and really believed that spirituality meant being otherworldly, being very sensitive, very, very perceptive, you know, in altered states and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I come into this life, and as a child, I mean, this is me. I'm very otherworldly. I'm very super sensitive,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, I can't get it together, you know, in the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to realize that, you know, that's okay, but what if you're responsible for someone and someone's welfare, and you space out and something bad happens to that person? Is that spiritual, you know? And I began to rethink that whole thing. What if you're so sensitive that you can't maintain a relationship? You know what I'm saying? So I began to get balance, and I realized that reincarnation is about balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about realizing that too much sensitivity, too much otherworldliness is actually a weakness. But as long as you're believing that this is unequivocally a strength, you can't even begin to learn the lesson. So the first lesson is to learn that it's a weakness in the first place, and this goes for all kinds of addictions, everything you can name, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's people walking around that think that alcohol is wonderful, and the more you drink, the better it is, and, you know, and that there's nothing wrong with it, and so on, and until they face the downside, the shadow side, the part that's in your blind spot.
Well, you know, the big question that comes up today when we're dealing with terrorism and what we would call evil, what do you think about evil?
Ah, well, I have to go back to my guru's teachings on that, Meher Baba. But my understanding of it is that, see, this is a tough one. It's a tough one to explain in a couple minutes or something.
I know.
But I'll try. My understanding of it is that there's the Godhood, which is absolute. All the qualities are contained in the Godhood, and they all mesh together seamlessly.
Mm-hmm.
Strength.
The Godhood being in everyone.
I'm sorry?
The Godhood being in
everyone. Right, in everyone. And at that level, all of the opposites are harmonious.
Right.
And
uh-huh.
the example would be strength and kindness. So Jesus, as a representative of the Godhood, will stay with Jesus, was both as gentle as he could be and as strong as he could be, although our culture has lost sight of that to some extent. C.S. Lewis tried to put that back with Aslan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But as it trickles down through the manifested universe, as it gets down to the physical level, all those dichotomies are at war with each other. So you have people who are very strong and zealous and have a strong sense of brotherhood and devotion to a cause, and that's good. That's part of one of the divine attributes, you know. But
yeah.
They don't have compassion, understanding, tolerance, the hippie virtues. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we have the hippies, the women out here naked saying no war, and then we have these, you know, these guys that are, you know, blowing themselves up in the name of Allah.
Right.
And they both have something, you know, but, you know, I hate to say it like this, but really speaking, you have to have strength and compassion together.
Right.
Because if you only have the strength, you've got a dictator. You've got a Saddam Hussein or somebody who's very strong and very charismatic but has no compassion.
Uh-huh.
See, so that's, so,
but
so
do
the
you
point
think
is that those things gradually come back up towards the Godhead. And as they get closer toward the Godhead, you get a balance where both of them come together.
Uh-huh.
And you have a person like maybe more like John F. Kennedy who can be very strong and very kind at the same time, or Carter or somebody like that. See?
Uh-huh.
So it's relative, but it's not, it's relative in relation to the absolute, which is the error I'm trying to avoid here. It's not all relative. Good and evil are relative, but they're relative in relation to where they come from.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense?
Yes, very much so. It's
okay.
A huge subject, very profound,
yeah,
and very
cover in, yeah, a minute or two. But.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's very, it's an antagonistic subject.
Well, yeah, but the thing is that Meher Baba said, never say that anything anybody says is wrong. Everybody's like partly right, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody's partly right. So where you got to look is, where's the error? I mean, given that they're partly right and what they're into is partly true, where's the error in it, and how can that be? How can that be brought up, you know?
Well, Steve, what do you think about all the people that are dying of disease and are helpless victims in all these wars that are all over the world? How does that fit, in your opinion, in the whole reincarnative subject?
I don't think there's any accidents, and I'll take a hard line on this one. I don't think there's, I think the moral order of the universe demands that there's no mistakes.
Right.
And there's no coincidences and there's no mistakes, and something bad can't possibly happen to you unless it's drawing out of your own bad actions. But the thing is that we've lived so many lifetimes and we've had so many bad actions that this is just the tip of the iceberg. You know, we all of us, every one of us have done, you know, so many horrible things. If you look at history, and if you read like Roger Wolger's book, Other Lives, Other Selves, and you look at the things that they start remembering that happened to them,
mm-hmm.
Well, we all did that. I mean, it wasn't like somebody else that did that. All of us did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm reminded of Oppenheimer when they set off the first bomb. He said, I think he said, now we're all sons of bitches.
No. He said
did
we,
right or not?
He's seen the face of death.
I think he said the other two, but I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But as
he was quoting the Hindu scripture.
Right, he did that, and then I think the other quote is in there too, but I could be wrong. I grabbed bits and pieces of history,
mm-hmm.
but which I shouldn't do. But anyway, the point is that we've all done all these horrible things. None of us are immune. So when something bad happens to us, it's just drawing a little bit of the vast store of bad karma that we all have.
In other words, what we put out returns to us. It's not punishing. It's more or less just returning to its source.
It's just a bulb coming back off the wall, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it has the moral element. There's another thing. I'm going to try to get to this, but I don't know quite how to get to it. I think that this huge storehouse of bad karma is held in abeyance as long as we are learning our life lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get attempts, like knocks on the door. You know, you're not learning your lesson. Knock, 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 and you send them away. Another knock comes on the door. A person comes into your life. A situation comes up. The situation comes up again. You get the opportunity to look at it. You get the opportunity to look in your blind spot again and again. Finally, when absolutely nothing is getting through to you, some piece of your karma is allowed to come through the pike and shock you.
Uh-huh.
So that's the way I see it. And I saw that maybe 10, 15 years ago, you know, I began to look at it and I began to realize this whole idea that things are arbitrary and God is cruel and how could he let these things happen? It's not that. He keeps trying and trying and trying. And the guides and the people that are trying to help us keep trying. And only when we absolutely are refusing to listen, you know, is some piece of our own karma allowed to come down the pike and shock us into awareness. That's the way I'm looking at it.
Yeah, that's a very interesting approach. Tell me, do you think there's anyone alive, including the Dalai Lama, that is free of karma?
Not that I personally know of. I understand that there are always God-realized beings on the planet, but I don't know any. The closest I know was Baba Hari Das. Who, if you've read Be Here Now, that was Ram Dass's teacher, not his guru, not Neem Karoli Baba, but Hari Das was his teacher who would come out and teach him something every day.
Uh-huh.
I met him at a retreat in 1974. He still runs or is involved with or kind of behind the scenes at Mount Madonna, I believe it is. There's a website. It's linked from my website. He's probably the most advanced being I've ever met personally, and that was quite a retreat.
How did that manifest? How do they seem advanced?
I would have to tell you the story of it. One of the things that would happen is that there'd be a group, 15, 20 people sitting there, and he wrote on a slate board. He didn't talk.
Uh-huh.
And maybe there was something that you needed to hear, and you were too shy or you weren't quite self-aware enough or whatever. You wouldn't ask it. Suddenly somebody would be asking it on the other side of the room.
Uh-huh.
But the question would bounce over and hit you right in the heart, you know.
Uh-huh.
He could see right through you. I mean, you know, he could see your just all your karma right at a glance, you know.
Uh-huh.
All that. Now, I went up to him, and this is way before I ever had this past life regression, okay. This is 74, I'm 19 or whatever it was, 20 or something. And I just quit drugs 6 months ago, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I went up to him, and I asked him a couple questions. One of them was, how can I serve God? And he wrote down a very disappointing answer. I thought, he said, don't hate anyone. And I thought, what is this?
Uh-huh.
I don't hate anyone. This is silly. I want to know, should I go out? Should I do the soup kitchen? Should I, you know, join the Peace Corps? You know, I want to answer like that.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't a good enough answer. So I went and asked him again later. You know, I mean, we're pretty raw sometimes. I asked him again. He wrote down very, very patient. He says, don't hate anyone. So 20, 30 years later, I'm starting to realize, ooh, you know. So, in other words, he could look right into my karma at a glance and do that, and that was what I needed, you know. And there were some other things that happened with regard to drugs. I asked him about drugs, and he said, drugs are ruining you. He was very direct about that.
Uh-huh.
And I thought about it later, and I thought, that's a very compassionate thing to say, because what he's saying is, you're a fine human being, and look what drugs are doing to you. Not like, it wasn't like a criticism of me.
Uh-huh.
You know, he says, drugs are ruining you. Stop taking them. I mean, he told me flat out, stop taking them, and I hadn't. You know, I never had since. I've been clean for 6 months.
So he got through.
Yeah. But see, also, I was ready to hear it.
That's right. Yeah. And you created him to say it.
I'm sorry?
And you created him to say it.
In a way, yeah. Me at the highest self, yeah, at the highest level. Yeah.
Now, your documentary, you know, you're attempting to bring East and West together under this umbrella of a kind of sociological overview.
Right.
So how do the approaches of East and West differ regarding the subject of reincarnation, and why didn't you address the issue of reincarnation and religion in your documentary?
Okay, well, first of all, when I look, of course, religion and spirituality aren't necessarily the same thing.
Right.
So, you know, there's the esoteric and the exoteric. So I've always been concerned with the esoteric. I've never really been that concerned with traditional religions.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started studying the different religious scriptures and teachings of three or four different contemporary masters, I started with the assumption that these guys are all talking about the same reality, the same experiences,
mm-hmm.
different cultures. So when I talk about Eastern, you know, spirituality, that's what I mean.
Okay.
So I'm not looking at the religions. But if you look at the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, the Buddha, if you know how to read the New Testament, the teachings of Jesus, because they've been distorted, but if you know how to read them, and contemporary spiritual masters, I read Sri Ramakrishna, my guru Meher Baba, I read Paramahansa Yogananda's autobiography of the yogi,
mm-hmm.
And Hari Das has a little book, you know, and they're all coming from this point of view of experience the highest, realize the highest, and everything else will be clear to you by revelation, basically. So,
God, how do you experience the highest? How do you get there?
There's methods. There's the different yogas. You know, there's Bhakti
yeah.
yoga, Karma yoga, Raja yoga, and so on. I mean, basically you do it by getting rescued by a realized being is what I think you do. I think you go through God knows how many lifetimes trying it on your own until you fail miserably and one of them reaches down, grabs you by the scruff of the neck, pulls you out of the dirt. That's my personal feeling. But other people may feel differently. But there are ways. But basically, when you align yourself with one of those teachers, you get by proxy, you get an intellectual understanding because your intellect is hooked into something that goes beyond the intellect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're receiving indirectly, you're receiving revelation through Scripture. I mean, it's not a new idea, you know, revealed.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
So it's revealed truth is the
right.
Eastern point of view. And you know, Jesus was from the Eastern model also.
Right.
But in the West, we're talking research, we're talking science, we're talking going from the ground up, from the manifested multifarious universe to back up to the source. So we're laboriously studying and testing and theorizing and thinking and trying to help people who are sick and that kind of thing, working from the ground up rather than from the top down. And those two are coming together. So this is what my documentary was really trying to show, was how those two approaches and two cultures are coming together around this issue of reincarnation.
Well, do you... how do you, since, do you think reincarnation was ever taught by Jesus?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one really clear reference.
When he says, and who do you say I was, and who do you say I am?
To me, the clearest one is in, I think it's John verse 9, where the disciples say, why was this man born blind? And they give him Jesus a couple options. Was it because of something his parents did,
mm-hmm.
or was it because of something he did? Sin? Did he sin? Who sinned? I think they say, who sinned, him or his parents? And the man was congenitally blind.
Right.
So, you know, at what point did he commit the sin? I've actually had a Christian theologian tell me that it's because the child sinned in the womb. And I don't know if I can say this on the air, but honestly, what sin could it possibly be except he touched himself, you know? So does God make a guy blind because he touched himself as a fetus? I mean, give me a break.
Uh-huh.
So clearly, Jesus was nodding to the theory of reincarnation as one of the plausible alternatives. And then the answer is no, it was for the glory of God to be manifest.
Now, how did he clearly touch on reincarnation in his answer?
Because in the question. So the disciples clearly believed that reincarnation was a possible explanation
mm-hmm.
when they presented the question. Mm-hmm. In the answer, I would say that if reincarnation was a doctrine of the devil or a horrible thing or a terrible mistake or heresy, that Jesus would have taken that opportunity to clear that up. And what he said was, no, it was for the glory of God to be manifest. And briefly, from the reincarnationist point of view, that fits perfectly with the idea that people have some choice about, you know, their condition when they incarnate.
Mm-hmm.
So that person, presumably Jesus was saying, no, that person gave this blindness to me as a gift so that to be part of my ministry so that I could heal him and show the glory of God. The man chose it. In this particular case, this is...
Yeah, I don't know that that's an answer to my question, what did Jesus discuss reincarnation as it is in the Bible today? I believe, as you do, that it used to be there. There's another one in Matthew when he does ask the disciples, then, who do you say I am?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And who knows what the transfiguration meant?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those can be interpreted a couple different ways, but it sounds pretty clear, again, that he's taking for granted the teaching of reincarnation. I think it was totally taken for granted at the time, and it wasn't a subject of particular note.
Yeah, this was what he was teaching, and I know that Pontius Pilate's wife was a student of his
mm.
and believed these things.
Mm.
But then, you know, if someone asks him about reincarnation in relation to past lives, he would answer it truthfully on in whatever way the parable would be stated, that there is no such thing, that it's all happening now. And that's harder to paraphrase.
I think that's a little harder to understand. There's a section, and I don't know where this is. Maybe you can help me out because it's been a long time. But the disciples asked Jesus a similar question. There's people that were killed by a tower falling on them. I think it's 9 people.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, what did these people do? And this is where Jesus basically says, the way I reinterpret what's come down to us, Jesus said, no, not just these 9, but all of us have done, you know, things worthy of a tower falling on us.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying.
You know, in past lives, but that's been edited out. And then he says the axe is laid to the root of the trees that are not fruitful. And again, he's saying what I said earlier, which I'm drawing on Mayor Baba's teachings, but Jesus says the same thing, that basically if you're learning your life lessons, if you're doing your work here, all those things that all of us have done are held in abeyance. But when you're sloughing off and you're not getting the message and you're not working on your lessons, that stuff's allowed to come in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, it's all there in the New Testament, but it's been edited. And
oh, well, sure. We know that.
That's my personal feeling, anyway.
But why didn't you address this issue of reincarnation in your documentary?
Well, because I haven't found that traditionally minded religious people are open to it. I've made some pretty strong statements, which I might not make on the air, but basically they're not open to discussion. They have certain set ideas, kind of like an interlocking web of prefabricated concepts.
Why are they so resistant to it?
Well, I think it's the same reason we cling to everything. They're clinging to the outward form of religion, and it's a stage.
But you know, Steve, because they don't embrace it as much as we wish they would, they're really not taking responsibility for their own issues.
Well, it depends on what stage they're in.
Mm-hmm.
Because at one stage, you know, it's like I think Sri Ramakrishna talked about a plant growing up. And when a plant is very young, you put a guard around it, yeah? A tree. When a tree is just a sapling or a seedling, you put a little wire mesh around it or something to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's bigger, you know, you take the mesh away and you put it outside in the ground and it grows up and becomes a huge thing. So I think that in the early stages of somebody's spiritual development, I think it's necessary. It's not without its attendant evils, but it may be necessary.
What's necessary?
Traditional religion. You know,
yeah, but that's when you put the blocks up so early that they're hard to
knock down. We have so many lifetimes to go through all these stages, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's not that big a hurry. And this is the thing is this is where good and evil are relative. It depends on what you're learning, what your lesson is. You don't expect a first grader or a second grader to be writing essays, you know, on what they did this summer. You know, you just don't. That's for fifth graders and sixth graders. And you don't expect fifth and sixth graders to be doing college-level work and so on. But the only problem that comes in is when you have a fifth grader that's not trying to learn his, you know, fifth-grade material.
Yeah, but okay, but a fifth grader who's also been
blocked
by tradition.
I'm sorry?
You also have the fifth grader then who's been blocked by tradition, or to use your analogy, by the cage around the small tree.
Right, it becomes what was a protection ends up becoming a cage.
Yeah.
But that's also a stage. It might take a lifetime or 2 lifetimes or 3 lifetimes. I don't know how long it takes.
How do you think acceptance of having lived before would change Western society?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And again, it depends on what stage you're at. I do think that an acceptance of that at too early a stage. For example, for a long time in my documentary, I wanted to get proof. I wanted to get absolute proof that would shake somebody right to their boots, you know. And
yeah.
I couldn't get it. I could almost get it, but I couldn't quite get it. And Jenny Smedley, who's the author of Ripples, was the first person to tell me, you know, maybe it's not meant, you know. And I got to thinking about it, and I realized, you know, I look at these terrorists, they're convinced that they're going to live after they die. But what are they doing with it? You know, at their particular stage of personal development, what are they doing with that? You know, they're killing people.
We're all going to live after we die, but what are they doing with the experience of being alive is your question.
Right, right. Well, they don't have the personal development to deal with that. They'd be better off not believing in life after death. So I don't. If you convinced everybody here of reincarnation, regardless of their level of development, I don't know. You know how good a thing that would be. But that aside, I mean, that's an issue I've been thinking about, and I kind of backed off the whole proof thing when I started thinking about that.
Yeah, because proof, really, basically, anyway, is only experience, and that's
right.
What each person has or doesn't have.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, because you're not going to believe somebody else's experience. You're going to believe your
own. Right. It's got to happen to you.
Yeah.
How would you define the difference between skepticism and cynicism?
Yeah, I think they're opposites. I think they look similar, like a lot of things in life. I think Swami Vivekananda said that opposites appear similar, and I never could understand it, but here's a good example. The skeptic is so respectful of the truth that he refuses to take anything that might not be true on its face.
Mm-hmm.
So he tests everything because truth is sacred to him, because he doesn't want... And Tom Schroeder was that kind of person, the editor for the Post that I interviewed, Washington
mm-hmm.
Post. He is not going to take anything on anybody else's word because he respects what's true. You know, the cynic is the exact opposite. He's absolutely locked into his worldview, and he'll throw the truth away in a heartbeat, you know, if he has to, you know, in order to make his view appear to be right.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really opposites.
So you would prefer to work with skeptics rather
absolutely.
Than cynics?
Absolutely. I don't work with cynics. I just try to leave them be. You know.
But if you didn't include any of this reincarnation, which you didn't, in your documentary, then why did you have any type of resistance, or did you encounter any when you were making In Another Life?
Well, it wasn't so much over it. Every once in a while, I hit a flamer on a news group, you know, and I pretty much either I deal with them or I ignore them. But I did encounter a lot of subtle resistance in trying to produce it, and especially in getting permissions. And the one example that sticks out clearest for me, Linda Adler, who is the past president of the International Association for Regression Research and Therapies, IART, I interviewed her at the Edgar Cayce Foundation. She was giving a presentation there.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her for cases. Do you know any really good cases? And she said, she told me about a Captain Robert Snow, who is the head of the homicide department of the Indianapolis Police Department, whole city.
Mm.
And somebody had, a coworker had dared him to get a regression because they used it for child molestation cases and things like that. And she dared him to get a regression, you know.
To do one himself, you mean?
Yeah, to go for one himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he resisted, and finally, you know, man of great integrity, and he promised to do it, so he went and did it. So for 45 minutes, this is all explained in his book, Looking for Carol Beckwith.
Mm-hmm.
And he for 45 minutes, he experienced nothing except his rear end was hurting in the chair, you know, and he's thinking, this, you know, he's just nothing. And all of a sudden, bang, he's completely, this is one of those people that goes into the complete immersion experience. He's there in the office, but he's completely immersed in a past life. He's there physically. You can touch the trees. He can walk around, you know, and he went through three lives like that. And the third life was fairly recent. And when he came out of it, he says, I've got to disprove this. He didn't want to prove it. He wanted to disprove it. And he's a professional detective, and his wife's a detective, I believe. So he took his technical expertise, and he set about trying to disprove this thing. And he ended up proving it. 26 of 28 possible provable points that were in the audio tape session, he ended up proving. He found the past life person's diary, their scrapbook, you know.
I mean, he went back into his own past lives and found evidence.
He found absolutely solid evidence. It's one of the strongest cases in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to put this in my documentary. I had permission to go up and tape him. First off, I couldn't get any funding, you know, so that's another, nobody would pay any attention to me. But the other thing, I could have, you know, found a way to get up there. But if you know television work, you've got to show something. You can't just interview a guy and have a talking head for 15 minutes. You know, if he's talking about the past life person was a painter, you got to show the paintings.
Mm-hmm.
So I started writing the people that owned the rights to these paintings, and they were all very nice and sure, we'd be happy to help you. And then I said why I wanted it, and I never hear from them.
Mm-hmm.
Totally blew me off. So basically, because of their resistance, because of their cynicism, it was impossible to produce the segment. And that then becomes circular, because then the case never gets out to society.
Right.
Society doesn't know anything about it, doesn't believe about it, and the lack of is circular. You know,
mm-hmm.
So that's society's own denial mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
They don't let it in, so they don't see it, so they don't let it in. You know?
Yeah. Well, I have a theory about why in the West we like to think we live in a democratic culture and society, mm-hmm. and that we are taking responsibility for our actions. But if you really went into the self-responsibility of understanding why you do things, then you are the authority figure in your own experience.
Right, right. You're the master of your fate.
Right. And then what do we do with doctors and scientists and leaders and politics and other people that we are now saying, you tell us what to do. You tell us what is right or wrong.
Right.
We
well,
go
and,
by
and
the
it,
Constitution.
And it cuts a lot of
we
jobs
go by the precepts of what we think is fair.
Well, if you look at past life therapy, it's so effective. You know, one, two sessions, and the phobia that the person has been tortured with all their life is gone.
Right, yeah.
You
right.
know, and the medical problem, and the physical thing is gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so effective.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the tip of the iceberg. You
yeah,
know?
Really. And what does that do to all those professions? Who
I mean,
get
look at
paid?
Me. I'm in a good relationship 3.5 years.
Yeah.
You
know? So
you know,
what do you use? What are your tools for, accessing your past life experiences? Help some people out here who are listening.
Well, if you feel that you need a past life regression session, you can get referrals from IARRT. And they're still going by their old name, I think, on the website. So it's www.aprt.org.
What does that stand for?
The International well, I don't know what it was before, but it's now the International Association of Regression Research and Therapies.
Mm-hmm.
I have it right.
Mm-hmm.
And they will give you a referral, and then there are several referrals in your area. And then you look down and look at their credentials. And I would say go with somebody that's got the credentials to be a counselor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to start with, go with because you can get into a bad memory. You know, you can freak out, to use the colloquial expression.
Mm-hmm.
And you want somebody that can get you through that and pull you back out of it. And,
sure, some facilitator who's
right.
sophisticated and knows what they're doing.
Can handle it.
What? How did when you got into this good relationship that's working now? Did you have to work through or go into who you and she were before?
No, but I've gotten a pretty strong sense of it myself.
Mm-hmm.
The way you do that is you look at the feeling tone, the basic feeling tone of the relationship. You know, what does it feel like? You know, and in my case, we're first and foremost, I say we're really good friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this particular case.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels solid. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so you can get a sense. There's lots of ways to get clues about these things.
Where does sexual attraction fit into past life recognition?
Let's see. I think...
I mean, you don't particularly love the person, but you're sexually attracted to them. What do you do with that in relation to reincarnation?
You mean if you're in that situation and what do you do? It depends on your level. It depends on what you're learning and your level of development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if you're at a low level of development, you try to seduce them, but you don't rape them. And that's progress for you. You know, does that make sense? If you're at a high level of development, you don't get in a relationship. You know, it depends where you are and what, you know, how many lifetimes you've had and what you're learning and what's progress for you. I think in the Bible it says, to whom much is given, much is expected. Same idea.
Yeah.
So it depends on what's progress for you, because at the beginning stages, the point is to be responsible enough to, you know, probably go ahead and satisfy your desires without destroying somebody's marriage or without raping somebody or without taking advantage of somebody that's vulnerable. You know, I mean, those would be the basic lessons there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you learn those things first, I would assume. But I mean,
well, a lot of people going through that, Steve, who are attracted to someone who is married and that person is married too, and yet they really have this deep love and they have this deep attraction, both spiritually and physically, for, I guess, I'm forbidden fruit. Now,
exactly that problem recently, and you know, it was very tough for him. You know, he chose to quit, to back out and save his marriage. You know?
Who did this?
Well, this was someone that wrote me. Obviously, I can't, you know, mention the name.
Oh, I see. I just didn't hear you.
Yeah, someone recently wrote me and asked my advice. And what do I do? I've never believed in reincarnation. This was how he came to reincarnation. So I've never believed in any of these things. But as soon as this person was a dancer, and as soon as she came out and started dancing and I saw her, I immediately felt this tremendous recognition, like I'd known her before, and he fell in love, and he's obsessed, and, you know, and he can't eat and sleep and the whole thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I told him, I totally understand the feeling, but, you know, it's up to you what you do, but, you know, here's the best karmic scenario, you know, it's just you can't tease yourself and sit on the fence and try to hang out with her, and, you know, you need to cut it off and, you know, move on.
Well, why? Maybe the other solution would have been to recognize the spiritual beauty of it and to go with that person.
It's possible, but when you're in a situation of giving general advice to somebody you don't know, I took the safest route and went that way.
Yeah, you pull punches, don't you?
I'm sorry?
You pull your punches.
Yeah, I do, because I did in the documentary, too. For example, I didn't talk about OBEs at all, out-of-body experiences.
Well, yeah, why not?
I have a concern. I have a concern that if I'm putting out a documentary that's seen by, 20,000 or 4,000 teenagers, and two of them get into trouble trying it out, I have a problem with that. So I did pull my punches a little bit in some respect.
Well, tell our listeners, because I'm going to tell them how to get your documentary. Tell them what it actually is saying.
Well, let's see. In two words or less, it's saying that Americans are, by lots of different means, coming to have an encounter with the phenomenon of reincarnation, not the idea or the belief. It's a real thing. And
the experience of it.
Right, the experience of it, directly or indirectly, but they're encountering it. And the documentary basically first establishes that it's real through the scientific research of Dr. Ian Stevenson. Tom Schroeder, the journalist, the editor for the Washington Post, says, yeah, I followed Stevenson around. I was skeptical, but he's getting the results he says he's getting. It's real.
Mm-hmm.
So the journalistic element of society, that institution says it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Science, Stevenson is a respected psychiatrist who's been doing this for 40 years. Science says it's real. And Dr. Robert Almeter, who's a philosopher, a philosophy professor at the University of Georgia here in Atlanta, he says it's real.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got the institution of academia, the institution of journalism, and the institution of science. They all say it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I've established that at the front of the show.
Okay.
Then I move on and say, here's the ways people are encountering it. Here's a woman whose 3-year-old son starts talking about his past life.
Mm-hmm.
There's one way.
Mm-hmm.
Here's somebody who had a flashback. She's sitting at a restaurant, she's starting to eat, and the food reminds her of something, and bang, she's there.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another guy who has an experience walking along Antietam, Jeff Keane.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating case. And he's walking along the road at the battlefield at Antietam, and suddenly he has this horrible emotional flashback.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on he runs into a picture of this person, and it's like the same guy. I mean, they look identical. I interviewed Jeff Keane on the gravesite of John B. Gordon, so I've got probably the first time anybody's ever filmed an interview on the person's own grave.
One of the things, there's a case of a woman who began to see things in her own children that reminded her of some haunting feeling. She didn't know what. Then she got into thinking, God, maybe I knew them. And she traced her background back to Ireland. I think I've got this right.
Jenny Coquel? Jenny Coquel you're talking about?
No. I don't remember the name. And it ended up that her children were her parents before.
Oh, okay. No, you may be talking about Carol Bowman's book, Return from Heaven, is that it?
I don't remember.
Okay, yeah, that happens. And Carol Bowman's second book, Return from Heaven, talks about cases where people are reincarnating back into their families.
We've been trying to do pictures on this subject. There's a book that's been bouncing around Hollywood for 25, 35 years called Forever, written by Mildred Cram.
Mm.
And all the best screenwriters there were in Hollywood took cracks at this. They're like 18 screenplays or something.
Oh.
And the problem is, when you go back and see who you were before, you look different.
Most of the time, not always.
And particularly if you're were in another sex previously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who do you get to play those parts?
Yeah, it's tough.
There's another theory, Steve. I want to ask you about this, and then we'll be done. But there are some theories now bouncing around that reincarnation was not part of the human experience in the beginning, that it came into being because the human did not want to resolve their issues in the third-dimensional reality now and said, well, I'll put it off.
Uh-huh.
I'll decide what I'm going to decide about who I am when I'm in heaven. And therefore, boom, the theory of coming back to learn the lessons that they wouldn't resolve before were born. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, we're getting into the long history. I do know that there's the four ages that are spoken of in Hinduism, and I think in the West they're called the Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the Iron Age, moving upward in the upward cycle towards the Second Age now, kind of on the cusp of that. And that these cycles cycle over and over and over and over, and they wear out an Earth, we get another Earth. I mean, these are like, you know, we have no idea how many cycles, how big this thing is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you place yourself at the declining end of the Golden Age,
mm-hmm.
my guess is that at that point, people are not really in physical bodies. They're in a rarefied, you know, body of some kind, and they're probably not incarnating per se.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we think of it, they're probably not in, and there's a fall from there, because inevitably we have to go back down through those ages. So there's some kind of a fall at that point,
and
that wouldn't just happen once. In long, long scheme of things, it would be many, many times, you know, because this thing just keeps, this grand cycle just keeps going. But
the other interesting thing is how these experiences are felt through the chakra system, and that each one of the seven chakras has its own experiences that need to be resolved. So in other words, to become a master, to become an enlightened, realized being takes, in terms of time, a lot of it.
Yeah, I'm sure that looking at the chakras, it corresponds or parallels a person's development, so that
mm-hmm.
the energy is gradually moving up through the chakras, and their development and their awareness is gradually moving up, and the issues that a person has, that's part of their life lessons for this life, would correspond to certain chakras. It all would tie in and just be different ways of looking at the same.
Right. And I learned when I was in India, when I saw so much poverty and so many people who could hardly function, I thought to myself, you know, that could be a master.
Mm-hmm. Right. You don't know. Exactly. You don't know who somebody is, you know. And one of my spiritual mentors told me, you know, you don't know who somebody is from just one lifetime by looking at them.
Yeah. You sure don't. Well, thanks, Steve. This has been terrific. Let me just remind everybody that your video is available on our site, and it's something I think you'll really be interested in. I think you would like it a lot. It's called In Another Life, and he's taking it mostly from the point of view of the cultural attitudes towards us and towards each other. And let me just say here, too, let me remind you to join in the Healness and Wellness Center of prayer and meditation after the show tonight. Maybe what you want to do is feel into something that's bothering you and how it might have come up in the past. And also tune into the Cooking in the Light show on Monday, August the 4th. Thanks again, Steve. I appreciate this. It was very interesting.
Thank you very much, Shirley. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.